My name is Trip Gorman, and in this episode of SME VC, I sat down with Rafa Barroso, an engineering manager at Apple and a former solutions architect at Google. Rafa is also an advisory board member at Dukes Capital, an angel investor, and a former founder himself. In this episode, we discussed how he adds value as a technical angel investor, why you need a technical co-founder, and why co-founder relationships destroy most startups. We talked about all this and more in this episode of SMEA VC. Okay, Rafa, could you start by telling the audience a little bit more about your work history, up to and including what you're doing right now?
Yeah, for sure, Trip. So I'm what you will call a founder turned founder. So pretty much went through the whole journey of, you know, I started working in the corporate world, doing some IT stuff, but then later started getting the itch of founding my own company. I met my co-founders. We try one thing, we try another thing, you know how it is, until we actually found a successful formula. Long story short, that started with through the full cycle of raising money and then finally being acquired. And that, like anything else, right, gives you another perspective. And the way that I like to think about it is that show me that I can also give back after that experience, and decided to jump into a little bit of what the, you know, angel investment game is. So after my own company, which I was a CTO and co-founder for about 7 years, I decided, you know, at some point that the company was a maturity point where I could move on. And I joined Google for a few years, first as a customer engineer, then a solutions architect, always very aligned to more of an engineering and technical track. And then just recently, a year and a half ago, joined Apple as an engineering manager. So still very focused on a lot of the same stuff I was doing with my own startup, but that will be my full time. And then on the side, for the last 5 years, I've been doing a lot of angel investment. When I say a lot, you know, I have about 20 plus companies in my portfolio, always with a thesis of finding something very unique in terms of like what I'm looking for in founders, some kind of energy, some kind of background. And yeah, I mean, I'm kind of industry agnostic, and I'm still learning. To be honest, I think the angel investment is more about educating yourself and learning every day from every experience. But with the journey to be at some point actually being able to lead a fund or something around those lines.
Amazing. Amazing. So there's so much to discuss there. And I want to just start talking about the angel investments right away. So you said sector agnostic. How big are those checks? What sort of companies do you like, even though you are sector agnostic? And then what are you most excited about right now?
Well, first check size, I go normally, I'm a very early stage, focused angel investor. So, you know, I do like 5K, 10K, that happens very frequently. When there's something that is very attractive about the company, I will normally do about 15, 20K. So that's like, okay, you know, let's go for it. One particular thing that I decided was to always, follow on. So some of my companies, the companies in my portfolio that have hit, you know, like the post-seed, Series A stage, and they raise money again, I normally will come in again, not because of, you know, dilution or whatever, but just because I'm excited. I've seen that there's definitely a clear path to success, right? So that those checks are always around the 20-25K. So that's my check size. What I'm looking for normally in terms of like, yeah, I'm industry agnostic. Normally, I don't get too far into, you know, like very new things. Like I have to be honest with you, I'm not like a crypto, NFT, blockchain, not because I don't like it, because it's not my area of expertise. My career has shown me, you know, a lot about e-commerce, finance, so very familiar with fintech. I like also everything around healthcare, although it's not like, you know, like something that I know a lot. I actually know a little bit, enough to not go and, you know, make some decisions around investment. And then everything else, you know, ed tech, future of work. I have some companies that are more on the marketplace side of things. All of that is, you know, something that I feel very comfortable with. What excites me the most, obviously, is the, you know, the trend right now. And it was exciting me before it was completely cool, the Gen AI. So I've always been very excited about data plays and the AI. For the last 5-6 years, right? And so some of the companies in my portfolio that have been tinkering with AI and doing great things, They are doing great right now. They're riding the wave, right? Because they started before the wave came. But yeah, looking right now into other opportunities that use Gen AI, not necessarily as a gimmick or something that is on top of something, but more as the core of the value proposition of what these companies have to offer, right? And what excites me the most also is that, you know, founders that are like super focused, they are working on something that they believe in, but also are experts in or have like a strong background, that always give me a lot of confidence. So regardless of the industry, if the person that is leading the company is familiar with the challenges, has the right connections, knows, you know, what challenges are they are facing and knows the competition, I'm, you know, that's all I need. Sometimes I don't need to be the expert. They are the experts, right? So I trust that process. And the last question you asked me was, yeah, what I'm excited about, right? So I think I answer all of them.
You certainly did. And one of the things that you mentioned, you know, with your career was you're an engineer. And I have to admit, most of the people that have been on this podcast have not been engineers, if any. And so you bring a unique perspective to the angel investing. I'd be interested to know, how does your engineering background play into the types of investments that you're going to make at that stage?
You know, it's funny, but many times I would say that 80% of the companies I have invested, I was a mentor before for them. So it's been very organic, right? And how that relationship, their relationship started was mainly because they will come to me and say, well, you're a mentor and we have this situation. And it's normally a technical question, right? Should we do this or that, or a product question? So I have also some experience doing product management and everything around the development, R&D, all the way to probably, you know, like what you call go to market. So they come with these questions. I'm able to help them, I think, you know, from an engineering perspective. I tell, you know, this is what I've done in the past, or this is what I've seen working. And that creates that relationship. And that relationship that starts switching a little bit from only technical questions to now more of business decisions. Hey, Rafa, what would you do about this? Or we're thinking about it. So it allows me to create more of a rapport or a stronger relationship with the founder. And then I think it just happens to it, you know, at a point they are like, okay, we're racing now. Rafa, are you interested? Most of the time I know these people better than most investors out there, right? Right. Most investors are getting like a quick pitch, you know, and 15 minutes, 20 minutes with this. I've been, working with them for months at that point. And I trust them. I've seen them in their, you know, lowest. I know, you know, like where their weaknesses are, where their strengths. And I mean, I'm like, you know, I like these founders. I've seen how they deal with challenges. So the engineering, answering the question, the engineering side of things for me has been the entry point or the doorway into, you know, more complex conversations and creating those relationships. And I would say sometimes they come back, you know, even after a year being a mentor, then we suddenly get hit by, you know, some technical situation and I can jump in and help, right? But I would say it's just, like you say, a differentiator for me to just get in, my foot in the door.
That's amazing. I do like that engineering focus. I know you are so much more broad than that, but I feel like so much of the content, so much of the focus externally on startups is go to market, it's product, because that's all that's really seen. And then no one really discusses the engineering. So what are those engineering and technical problems that you see startups bring to you and some of the most common mistakes you're seeing?
Yeah, I think the most common, you know, when I focus a lot on early stage, like I said before, and the most common I see, obviously, is when some of the founders, or well, in some cases, decide to go and do an MVP, and they decide to subcontract that, right? Or they decide that it's not going to be that important because they just need to validate something. And they normally underestimate the level of effort. They underestimate how long it's going to take, also the challenges, the bugs that are going to come up. That whole situation, I think I'm very capable of coming in and kind of warn them about it and kind of see around the corners and tell them like, hey, you probably shouldn't do this or that. My suggestion, for example, is as long as your product is something which value, you know, the core proposition or the core value of your product is attached to the software, you know, like you're talking probably as a SaaS company, right? You probably want to have some in-house talent dealing with that, right? And you want to, you can definitely expand your team and have some subcontractors, or you can do, but I would lead, you know, at least on the thought leadership aspect or the design aspect, I will have that in-house with an expert or at least one of the founders should lead that. Common mistake that I've seen is some companies offer services even around product management you know, will give you a point of contact and they will do everything for you. So the only thing you have to do is come and discuss thing or throw some Figma. They will do everything. That's the worst normally because the results are never what you expect, right? You think it's going to be super transparent and it's just going to translate exactly to your vision. And that never happens. And then it's all the reiteration. You end up working even, you know, more and pretty much spending more hours and more back and forth if, sometimes when you do that. So that's the number one thing. The other thing that people normally come with questions about is like how to scale engineering teams, right? How to scale in terms of like, okay, you know, who is the critical person here? Do I need a back-end developer, a front-end developer? Do I need someone that is more of an infrastructure, you know, like a system administrator? And we always talk about that because there's no like there's no like set recipe for that. There's always aspects that you have to take into account. What's the product about? Does it rely on scalability? Does it have to be a super secure a product? Is it more of about a user experience thing? Is it an app? Is it a, so those conversations, right? I like to think that I have covered a lot of that stuff already, you know, from mobile development to backend development, apps. And normally I can give some guidance, right? Even from infrastructure standpoint. And yeah, I would say that the last thing on the engineering side of things that I feel like I'm able to help is optimization and making things a little more efficient in terms of like, hey, you know, we're doing, all companies start with things that don't scale. And making the switch from that to something that is gonna go from, you know, 100 users to 1 million users normally requires some guidance. So I'm able to, you know, offer some solutions in terms of tools and technologies that they can use to scale fast. But yeah, I would probably say those are like top three. There are 100 more, right? But those are the most common that I always see. How to scale, who do I hire? And you, should I be working directly on my product or should I just like give that to someone else, right?
I love it. One of the questions that I think people think about a lot on the for those of us who are not smart enough to code and don't understand the technology at the same level that the engineers do, where do people like me or founders who want to build something find that early technical talent at the level of a co-founder? Where do people find a technical co-founder? What should people be thinking about when they're kind of vetting and meeting people? How does that early process work?
Yeah, I would say that the number one rule for me, if you're looking for, you know, I think you hit the nail when you say looking for a co-founder, right? If you're coming to the startup world with a, you know, an idea that relies heavily on technology and you are not a technical person, you are not an engineer, you should be very open-minded about getting a technical co-founder. Like the technical co-founder will be key, right? Now, answering your question, how can I find them, right? The best answer I can give you is always go with people you have worked in the past and you've been impressed with. So maybe a previous employee or a rapport, right? Or maybe a previous boss, right? Or maybe someone that you work horizontally with, or, you know, that's, and as long as you know the quality of that work, if you know that person is focused and have the technical chops, you know, to take on the challenges, that's number one. Number two is not everyone is wired to be a founder, right? So you can have very smart person, very skill on engineering topics, but they won't have really what it takes in terms of like the uncertainty and, you know, like some of the challenges that are common in a startup. Keep that in mind too, right? Because you are like, it's not only about the talent. There's a good combination. A lot of the stuff can be learned. Really, engineers, I like to think that we are very capable to adapt. That's why we learn so many, you know, programming languages, where easily we can get into new problems and stuff like that. So the technical background is important, but it shouldn't be the first thing, right? It should be knowing that person is built to be part of, you know, like a startup environment, someone that can, you know, it's agile, that can make decisions quick, that, you know, it's adaptable. That's very important. So I always say start with your first, you know, closest circle, people you have worked with. Then if you haven't never worked with an engineer, you were never impressed with an engineer, that's a possibility, could happen. There's someone in your circle that has worked with someone like that that can make an intro. You know, I wouldn't recommend just going to a founders event or do like a, you know, like a, some speed dating and find someone and say, yeah, come work with me. I'm a strong believer that they have to be like a previous relationship or a recommendation or something that will give that peace of mind, right? And even with that, there's not 100% guarantee that it will succeed, but at least you will go through the first phase of building an MVP, understanding, you know, what are the technical challenges and set the basis for whatever is next.
Amazing. And then so you've been a mentor for so many startups. You've been an angel investor for so many startups. You've mentioned some of the things that might lead to challenges, like if you didn't work with them before. What are some of the biggest challenges that you've seen startups, maybe some stories without any names of issues that have arisen that have really given you some insight that maybe wouldn't be just totally understood if you hadn't gone through it?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, number one challenge, obviously, for most of the startups are early stages raising money, right? That's a big problem. It's so many factors, right, that you have to take into account to for that specific one. But I can say it's a common denominator for more startups, for most startups. You have, like, obviously the outliers that will come and, you know, raise money like super quickly in a couple of months, they have it. But I would say 90%, especially this last couple of years, but being struggling, right? Like to raise money, that's a big challenge. And I think the challenge doesn't come from raising the money only, it comes also from the perception they have about, oh, it's gonna be hard, but they don't really know how hard it's gonna be, right? And what I've seen, especially nowadays, right, is a lot of discouragement, right? And I think my job there is to come in and say, well, you know, this is expected, it's supposed to be hard, keep going, keep grinding, like you can do it, right? So that's a common thing, that will be number one, right? I know it's not technicalized, no, it's like big wrong. Number two, which is funny for me, it's sales, actually. Like customer acquisition is tricky. So you have great visions with great founders, great products already, but struggle to get that adoption, right? Even if you're a B2C, then how can I get those subscriptions up? If you're a B2B, all these long cycles talking to some other companies that at the last minute decide not to be with you. So I see that a lot where, you know, the idea, there's always this very optimistic point of view from founders when they are launching and we're talking to this company and we're talking to this one and the pipeline looks great. And I think that's also, I mean, it's a double-edged sword because you need to keep motivating and you want to see those logos and those names coming in. But at the same time, you have to know that more than half of them are gonna probably not materialize at least immediately, right? That it's gonna take some time, some of them years. So some of the challenges that I see is that when they start realizing that the cycle is too long, there's this decision, should we go for smaller companies that could adopt us easier but are going to pay us less, or should we just keep going for this big one but we could burn out, right? We could pretty much like run out of money if we just pursue these two. So I always recommend kind of like, again, ad hoc, see where the relationships are, what will be the benefits of getting the big ones. Can you do it in parallel? So sales, number two, right? It would be number one, raising, number two, selling the product or just customer acquisition or getting that traction that now is so, you know, it's so common that VCs or some angels were like, I want to see some traction. 2 years ago for early stage, you meet a founder, you see that energy, you understand a good vision and you say like, you know, that makes sense. Let's see how it goes, right? It's a bet at the end of the day. Right now, that traction is a little over the attraction or metric need for metrics is really overwhelming for some of the founders from what I see. And the last one I would say that is a very common challenge as well is co-founder relationships. I see it all the time as well, right? Like I think that's what destroys most startups, not being able to communicate expectations, not able to agree on things that might not be that important, right? Not being able to really power through the bad times together, you know, kind of pointing fingers. I think that founders that can get along well for, you know, like 2-3 years, they go above that bump. They are good. But the first couple of years, early stage, I would say that there's a lot of those dynamics that hurt the startups, to be honest, right? And my recommendation is always, you know, like trying to find the best way to find common ground and try to save the relationship because sometimes I would say many cases you can say a startup is benefited by the exit of a founder, right? But in other cases, you know that the combination of those two founders was that what made that startup, you know, special. And losing half of that or a third of that team will really, really affect the company. So yeah, those are, you know, common challenges. Without saying any names, I will tell you that half of my portfolio at least has been through maybe the three of them or one of those three, right?
Wow. Wow. Okay. So I want to take a huge step back. I want to talk about your career at large, right? Okay. So you went to school in Mexico, Tec de Monterrey, and then now you work at Apple in New York. and you spent some time at, you know, Apple, Google, two biggest companies. So tell us about that whole trajectory. And then I'm going to ask you, get ready, why you're not a founder yourself right now. Okay. So we're going to do that. I'm going to ask you that again. You don't need to answer that in this question, but right. I just want to get people excited. Tell me about your whole career, college until now.
Yeah, so I graduated back in 2000 and I moved to Monterrey. So I'm from Mexico City and I started working like very small jobs, right? I wanted to be a 3D artist originally. So I was trying to make a portfolio, do, you know, some shorts, some commercials, trying to get more into like 3D stuff. Unfortunately, in Mexico, at that point, there was not a lot of focus on 3D modeling and 3D animation. So, and you need to pay the bills, right? So I started getting more into coding. Some of these tools, you know, back then still need a lot of coding in terms of the physics and the lighting and animation. It's still mathematics and coding, and there's a lot of that that goes into it. So as I was coding, I started like, you know, seeing that coding was actually paying better. I worked for a couple of small software companies that were doing e-learning or like training, you know, like for companies, big companies, right? Like SAP or FEMSA in Mexico. And I thought this is cool. I like it. And then that took probably 5-6 years until I was more of a solutions architect kind of. So more than coding or on top of coding, I will be creating, you know, architecture, trying to find like, you know, how to solve a problem with technology. So that turned me a little bit into a consultant. I was doing great, but I always have like this idea of coming to the States to just, you know, for a couple of years or a few years come and learn something and take it back to Mexico. So I moved to San Antonio and I really had a big career change because as I was a solution architect before and I was doing, you know, a little more technical stuff, I kind of went to being kind of like a glorified help desk. Right, coming into an organization, a bank in San Antonio, where we were only two IT people. So I did that for 5 years. I always joke that, you know, I was doing one third of what I was doing in Mexico, where I was paid three times, you know, what I was paying in Mexico, because, you know, that's how it works. And it got a little, you know, tedious. It got too easy. And that I started looking for opportunities. Like, can I, you know, do you a website? Can I do an app for you? And some people, you know, will pay me for just like computer science classes. And that's just like, you know, kind of hustling there a little bit. And a friend of mine reached out to a point where he was like, what are you doing? Can you do a website? Can you do an app? And like, yeah, why don't we try to do stuff, right? So we tried to do, like I mentioned before, an app for runners. This back in 2011. Didn't go well, you know, we couldn't raise money, but got me into the entrepreneurship and all these like startup culture. I was like, this is exciting. Long story short, when, you know, we founded the next company, Techstars opened the doors to us and we decided that it was time for us to quit our full-time jobs. So I quit the bank and I joined my company for good. We took a big, you know, pay cut. I started doing kind of like the basically the foundation of the coding for the main tool. But as the company was growing, it gave me the opportunity to hire more engineers, start getting more familiar with, you know, management skills, leadership roles, all the way to, you know, formally become CTO of the company. And, you know, that was, I mean, I always say it's better probably than three MBAs, you know, like 7 years being a founder of a company that is like growing, generating money, expanding into different countries. All of that was amazing. And I think that curriculum and that career, you know, that's what Google saw. I got a Google phone call at some point and I thought about like, oh, you know, it's interesting. Let's do this Google thing to see what happens. I want to learn about the recruiting process so we can apply it to my own company, because I've heard that they are really good at hiring people, right? So I went through that and I put some effort, but not all of it really. And I ended up like being asked to, you know, like come to New York and have an interview here. And that went really well. So they offered me a good job. I was fully vested in my company. So there was some co-founder relationships, obviously, like we talked expectations and all that, but you know, we parted ways. I came with my family to New York, joined Google. I couldn't stand still. And I started getting involved in Google for startups stuff that will allow me to share more about that co-founder and that technical knowledge combined and offer that to startups, right? And yeah, so I worked mainly first in healthcare. I learned a lesson that I didn't know much about healthcare. And I was in sales as a customer engineer for the first time outside of my comfort zone, but being still technical. I'm going to be honest with you, I didn't love it. So I wanted to refocus on more technical stuff, right? So I became, again, a solutions architect, but now for Google, enabling partners in the retail, e-commerce, sustainability. We did a lot of work also on everything that had to do with payments. And I think that opened the door for Apple, you know, a few years later coming and saying, hey, you have a good background in payments and partner. You can join our Apple Pay partner engineering team, right? And I'm like, I think so, yeah. This role is very interesting because it requires some personal skills, being able to talk to other people, be very customer slash partner facing, but also be very technical in the sense that, you know, when you turn, you talk to your engineers, you say the engineering things, you turn to the customer or the partner, you can explain complex things in a more simple way. So I think that's an important thing that as an engineer, you can really, you know, develop a skill that allows you to have that communication. And yeah, so right now, you know, after a year at Apple, I had I was lucky enough to, you know, be offered now the management position, going back to kind of leadership, having a great team of software engineers. And you know, this is where we are right now in terms of you know, my technology journey and my career.
I got to give you praise on the communication skills, because the VCs are supposed to be sweet talkers. And I think you're beating a lot of them right now. You've done an excellent job in this interview thus far. So I have a few final questions. And, sure. And one of those is, you mentioned that you were making so much more in the US and doing so much less work, which certainly is the meme at a place like Apple or Google. But what's stopping you from being a founder or being a founder in Latin America right now?
That's a two-part question for sure. I mean, nothing is really stopping me from being a founder here in the States, I would say, but me, you know, like my expectations. I think that I got a little burned out from the previous experience. It was too intense. I had some mental health, because I powered through everything, right? And not until I left the company, I realized that I was just like internalizing so many things. So I needed a break. But I didn't want to be full, you know, like totally disconnected from the startup world. So that's why I stay in touch with founders and VCs and angels and all of that. At this point, I mean, it's something that I would still consider after the acquisition of my company. There's always a lot of possibilities of what you can do. I really wanted to take the you know, as I was already in this Apple journey, spend a little more time learning from these big companies, right? How they do things, how they scale, how they really solve worldwide, you know, challenges and problems, right? And I think that expertise can really, a year, a couple of years, or some years that I spend at Apple will really turn into, you know, very tangible results when I decide to start something new. So I'm not saying I would never do it again. There's the possibility. But to be honest, I think that founders have more fun than founders. And I think I'm directing my career more to become, you know, like a formal, from angel investment, formalize and become more institutional and probably join a VC firm or start my own thing. So that's if you want to say, I want to be a founder, yes. I want to be a founder of potentially a VC firm or something that is more aligned to what I've been doing in the last few years. And why not go back to LATAM? Honestly, that's a family decision. My wife, she grew up here. My kids, you know, well, my kid was born here. I have a daughter on the way. Like the US is my home now. And I've been so disconnected really from the LATAM culture. I made 20 years of career in the US that I might not be the best person to go and try my luck there, right? I think my feet are very grounded in America. And I think that, you know, that's where I want to be. And it's not an option. I have been offered, for example, leadership positions at Google to go to Mexico City or Rio. And I said, no, basically, I was like, that's not what I want for me. And this is home. Yeah, that's the reason, right? That I'm not a founder that's probably something that some of my startups in Mexico, I admire them and that the founders are great. But I know there's a lot of talent and they're going to do great, but it's not my story. It's not something that I see myself doing.
Okay. Well, finally, I have to ask Peter Thiel's famous contrarian question, but with a uniquely Samia VC twist. And I know you just said you're slightly removed from the Latin American ecosystem, but I'm about to ask this regardless.
Okay.
What is one important truth about Latin America or Mexico that very few people agree with you on?
I don't know if it's very few people, but I would say that my thoughts about in the BC world, right? I think that we are hurt by our, you know, it's a hard question to answer in the sense that I feel, at least this is a very personal opinion from my interactions with Latin founders, and these people are super talented, are awesome, but the common denominator that I see is that they believe in themselves for sure, but they normally they are shy about expressing how much they can get done, right? Like there's this very humble, or you know, trying to, whereas I think this is a big difference from the, you know, like the American founder, the American entrepreneur, it's always like dream big, right? And the level of confidence and coming. And we in Latam are a little more like, you know, okay, we want to keep things like very in control. We don't want to sound too braggy. We don't want to sound like also. So for me, it's about the confidence. I think that's as a VC, it's hard for Latin founders to project that same confidence that you will see coming from founders. There are exceptions, obviously, right? There are people very confident from Latam, I know for sure. But overall, if you take a sample, right, and you compare, the truth is that we need to believe more in ourselves. We need to believe that we are at the same level, that we are talented, that we're skilled, that sometimes we are solving problems that are not in the US. And that might be already something that we struggle to communicate or to, you know, show for. But at the end of the day, we still need to trust and be very confident that we are the right people to solve that problem as a founder. So that's what I would say that's hurting us a little bit, right? But we'll get there. I think the startup game in Latam is very, very early stage right now. You know, it's been a few years that we get this few unicorns in Mexico, in Colombia. And I mean, Brazil is obviously doing a great job in South America. But I think it's just the first you know, stage of all of this. It's the first chapter, right? And then we're definitely gonna work on all that stuff until we level the play field, and you see that confidence. You know, we need more success stories so people say, I can do it, he did it, we're all the, you know, like the same, let's go for it.
Amazing, excellent answer across the board on all of them. Rafa, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the Samia VC podcast today. I very much appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for watching this episode of Samia VC. Make sure to like and subscribe wherever you view the podcast. Follow me on Twitter @GormanTripp. And be sure to check out our newsletter, Deal Flow LA, which can be found by going to dealflow.la.